this is weird because people are like not there. So thanks very much for tuning in, everyone. Really appreciate it. Appreciate birthday wishes. Hope you're all safe and well during these times. And really, yeah, as I said, appreciate you guys jumping in on this. We got a few people. We got Kirk Vallis, Google man, turned all his kids' Wi-Fi off so he can get a video here now. We've got Nick Twigg trapped in Sedba due to Corona, can't get home to his wife and one child, so trapped with one child. And we got Stuart in Yorkshire, King of Yorkshire. Also, this is about those guys, so I'm going to get on with them quickly. Really about connection between sport and business. And we've just left it open to those guys to talk about some stuff that would resonate with them. Fire the questions in. We'll pick up questions along the way. And so without further ado, Kirk Vallis, introduced to me by Tom Tweddle, one of the strangest blokes I know at university, somehow CEO or high up in Google X. Really got introduced to Kirk when we started looking at card skills, so the C, the creativity of it. And I wrote down three words to describe you, Kirk. I wrote down challenging, connecting, and curious. So without further ado, over to you.
The three C's, I'll add a four, creativity.
Yeah.
thanks for that. Hey, folks. So bit of preamble from me, hopefully as much as anything, just to stimulate some questions. I'd much rather respond to specific context and stuff that people are working on. But sport and business, what am I seeing? Most of my time is spent at Google. That's my day job. Developing creativity as a skill. Yes, you know, we develop it. We think it is a skill that needs to be trained, developed, nurtured. So lots of time and investment gone into that. But I'm also really lucky to have spent some time in the world of sport with the likes of the English FA, England Rugby, Welsh Rugby, Adidas, who sit as a, you know, Adidas, a brilliant example of an organisation that is a business but works in and around sport as well. So that's my context and my perspective. For me, creativity is still a loaded word in both camps, sport and business. You say creativity, it means different things, often means the kind of the craziness that perhaps you can't teach, you can't coach. It's not critical. It's good for nice times. I think we need to reframe that. The World Economic Forum, McKinsey, you know, wherever you look, people are citing creativity as the most critical skill regarded in the world today. What do we mean by it? Just thinking differently. The ability to develop new options to make better decisions. That's how I frame it. We're brilliant at analysis, judgment, decision-making in the world, whether that's sport or business. It's just about shining the light on the need to create options. People say to me, how do I know I've come up with the best idea to solve that problem? You never will. You'll never categorically define you have the single best idea, plan, or solution to a challenge or opportunity. All you can do is bring more confidence to the decisions that you make. More options, better decisions is how I look at it. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things. This isn't the coronavirus edition, I know, and but what the whole current situation is doing for me is it's highlighted some really powerful things that I think are examples of creativity. And hopefully when we get back to some sense of normality, whether it's sport or the business world, hopefully more of these things will happen. So number one, creativity comes from anywhere. We talk a lot about looking outside of our world and getting perspective from others. Often that's quite casual. You know, most corporate environments like Google and so on are getting better at creating environments where people can collide together informally, maybe not planned, just to bounce thinking off each other. That doesn't happen in this current working situation. So how do we just get more deliberate about those casual collisions that we're going to have, whether, you know, even beyond this current lockdown and situation we're in? I think it is about valuing loose connection, the cognitive diversity. Let's get out of this kind of need. There's a lovely expression that I hear in Silicon Valley a lot of the time, and it's about valuing loose connections. We're pretty good at valuing strong connections. We've got a problem, right? Where's the expert in the world on this? Let's bring them in and learn from them. Actually, value loose connections. Who's got a perspective on this this challenge we're working on from a totally different angle. How can we go there? Just a couple of other things.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
Give me some good examples of how you or you've seen sports use loose connections to help with their kind of, creating different options.
So lots of stories I hear. I mean, I think sport's pretty good at it. Sport is pretty good at it, I would say, but I think they could go even further. So one thing I, so what have I heard? I don't know whether this was in Stuart's time or whether it was a part of Eddie's work at England, but looking at the world of judo, for example, to get a different perspective on how we might grapple and tackle and so on. So I think that's a great example that comes to mind of one sport learning from another sport, going, how do they do things? My push would be, how do you go even outside of sport, you know, to a totally different world? I'll flip it on its head. Rusty, we had this situation. I was working with my team. Our issue was confidence. So confidence was an issue. Learning development team, how do we build our confidence? We're being asked to operate at a more senior level with outside of our core skill sets. We learned loads, of course, from people in our world who are great facilitators and practitioners of learning development. But we learned so much by talking to you, Rusty. You remember developing confidence in elite talent. We learned loads from an RAF squadron leader. How do you build confidence in life or death situations? We spoke to the UK's first heart surgeon to perform heart surgery with a robot, and the person died. How do you get back your confidence following such a setback like that? And we even, and this is where I think would encourage people to go, have fun with this, because the further out of your core you go, the more you'll learn. We spoke to a con artist. We learned from somebody who made their living by building confidence falsely in them from other people to defraud them. And you might be going, well, what's that got to do with, you know, your business world? Well, we learned loads about fake it till you make it. You know, this guy would only try 2% new. That's what he said, 2% new every time. But I forced myself to always try something new. We learned loads from that we applied to our world.
Cool.
I'll stop there, I think.
Yeah, and the other thing what other stuff? I mean, someone asked me, actually, Jamie Williams said, if you could give kind of two or three principles that would be useful for sport based upon your business experience to take into it, what would those be?
So for sport from the business world?
Sport from business.
Sport from business. So, I think actually both sport and business could get better at this, but I hear so much in sport that, well, this is football, it's different. This is rugby, it's different. So I think we've just been talking about that a bit. So actually, if all we do is look inside our own worlds for learnings, it's a pretty limited pool. There's so much out there. So that's principle number one for creativity. Just value cognitive diversity. Beware groupthink. You know, there's lots of the way things are done around here in all walks of life, business and sport. One in sport is I see, you know, sort of, you know, a coach leaves a role, goes to a new role. They often take some of their team with them. You know, what's that perhaps doing? Now, there's loads of efficiency in that, but that's just created that. There's a potential there that you're just reinforcing groupthink and bias the whole time. So this need to constantly disrupt yourself, I would say, would be a big principle. Where does failure live? I ask this question all the time of people, where does risk live around here? A lot of people, again, in business or sport, can't often answer that question. It needs to live somewhere. Failure, now in sport, actually, I think this is a good example where business can learn from sport, because sport has lots of training, lots of time allocated to developing ourselves, getting better, practicing for peak moments. But could it be even more expansive? Could we try new things? We've got to find a home for failure somewhere. And lastly, I would just say this kind of like, where's the experiments? So not all corporates do this, but the most innovative companies I know, Google being one of them, we're obsessed with experiments. We're always running experiments. If you can test it, test it. If you can't test it, probably don't do it. but always testing our hypotheses. And I wonder whether that happens in the sport world. Again, because there's often, especially in elite sport, this pressure to win. The problem is you speak to an under-10s coach sometimes and they'll go, well, we've got to win on Saturday. It's like, that blows my mind. You know, like, we've got to create environment and space to try stuff. And in trying stuff, we've also got to recognise that it might not work. And just being more comfortable with this portfolio of success and failure. It's got to be more balanced.
Nice. And a good example actually of that is Max Kaldas, Dutch Olympic hockey winning coach. I asked him exactly that, where do you do your experiments? And he said, away from the cameras, against lower ranked teams and club teams, and we try some stuff out. Someone's just put a question, and I think it's worth asking just because, so someone's put more options, less clarity. So action, less clarity, question mark. So I think it might be useful to talk a bit about divergent, convergent thinking, and then maybe how you've done stuff with teams and in your environment around how you've facilitated that or what other people do to do that as well.
Well, let's, so what I would say, first of all, is you're right to kind of, you know, there's a risk with options that it's just you get choice paralysis and you just spend a whole time just going, what if we did this? What if we did that? That's not what I'm talking about. That's not helpful. That's the creative muse. But what I would say is that's rarely a problem. Like when people often say to me, well, you know, but we spend all our time coming up with ideas, it's just more confusing. I go, that's a lovely problem to have. Come back to me when you get there, because you won't get there. The reality is our brain, as many of us know, our brain loves one option. Our autopilot thinking will always generate one option for us. It's what it does. It's a brilliant thing about our brain. The problem with that is that one option will always be based on how it was done before, or a bit like it. You know, to quote Edward de Bono, he used a brilliant metaphor, rivers of thinking. You know, our brain is just full of channels of stuff of how it was done before, and we use that for efficiency. So that's the big watch out, is that often we are working on one option of how it was done before. So when I say about more options, actually for me, it's often just about pressing pause and going, what would one more option be here before I make that decision? If your autopilot brain is automatically feeding you one option, well, press pause, one more option, you do the maths, it's 100% more options that you're dealing with then. So I get it. We're not saying hundreds and hundreds of options for the sake of it when we've got a half hour meeting to plan a session and, you know, it's got to be good. But actually the reality is we're probably not spending any time on that kind of divergent, I call it expansive thinking, options and possibility, before we get into judgment, analysis, decision-making. And here's the big thing, creativity needs both. You know, most people think that I'm spouting that it's all about these just options and possibility. If that's all you do, that's crazy-tivity. That's not helpful, doesn't help creativity get a good reputation in the world, doesn't help us solve problems or opportunities. What it's about is building this agility in our minds, in our culture, in our teams, in the way that we behave with each other, where we recognize the need when we are about to make a decision, could we have another option? Get expansive, create a few more options, and then come back, get reductive, not a bad word, get reductive, analyze, judge, and make the decision, move forward. And then of course, execute brilliantly. You know, all of that stuff. And by the way, it's not 50-50. It's probably, I used to work as an innovation consultant. It was my job to come up with ideas every day for companies, brands, organizations. Looking at our timesheets, we still spent 85% of our time in reductive thinking mode, analyzing, judging, making decisions and getting stuff done. It's not 50-50, we're just asking for a little bit.
Cool. And then probably the other thing that I think would be useful for people to hear is like ways of doing that. So you're kind of 10x thinking, or you're, you know, the Brentford, you've got to win every game this season type mindset.
Yeah, so two really nice techniques. Now, what I will say is behavior eats process for breakfast for me. I, all the time, everybody comes to me, they've either spent a lot of money with a consultancy firm developing process for, you know, the way that they're going to do their business and the way that they're going to run strategy and so on. And then or the way that they're going to innovate, they bought every book. I think there's 27,000 books on Amazon right now on creative thinking and innovation. Go buy one, they're all good. But they only work if the behaviors are right. So what I would say is, you know, I could share techniques all day long and you can go and look them up. But unless we've got the right behaviors and culture within our organization or even just within our teams where we nurture new thinking, where we allow someone to come with a crazy thought and it's not immediately judged, it's given that time and that ability to be kicked around, if you like, without judgment and without pressure that it's got to go somewhere. You know, 90% of what we create is rubbish. We need it to get 10% that's good. So I think a shout out to behaviours there. And people ask me, well, what does one of your training programs look like? You know, 60% of any time I spend with a group, whether it's a day or a week, is spent on behaviours and really practicing how we facilitate behaviours. So I would give that a good shout out. But then, of course, there's some lovely things that we can do when we need to force our brain out of its river of thinking to start to make some fresh connections and new ideas. One is that point we spoke about earlier of loose connections. So I call it related worlds. Who in the world would give us a perspective that's a bit different on our challenge? It's about going and stealing with pride. So I think that's one principle that we can do. Always generates new thinking. I call it naive expert. So if I am going to go to a related world, I want that expert to stay naive. The watch out, if you give them too much context about your problem, they start trying to solve your problem from you. You want to suck their brain of what they know. That's my biggest thing that I work with. When I go into sport, you know, I'm a sports fan. I see the shiny lights and I want to go and try and solve that sports problem. That's not why I'm there. I'm there because I'm naive to that world and can offer a perspective that's totally different. So I think, you know, when you do go to other worlds, keep them naive to your challenge. Just break it down to its lowest common denominator, as we did with you, Rusty. Confidence. Tell us about confidence in sport. Didn't tell you anything about our world. So I think that's one principle. And the other one, which you touched on, is that we call 10x thinking. Break the rules. So I'll give you the story that Google X tell. Imagine we're all car mechanics. And I ask you to create a car engine that's does 50 miles a gallon. Pretty efficient. You would be able to do that from within your technical expertise, your how your brain has looked at it before. Your river of thinking comes into its own. Your experience and everything you know will help you to tune that engine to get that little bit more out. If I say it has to do 500 miles per gallon, your brain is forced to think about it differently. So it's a big thing. So we call it 10x thinking. Some people might have heard about it if they research sort of Google's innovation principles. And it works really well, but it's a great example where it only works if the behavior of playfulness and so on is around it. To your point, working with Brentford, we did an exercise with the Brentford team and the challenge that we set was, you know, we've got to win, we've got to beat Leeds 7-0, so they couldn't score a goal, we had to score seven. By blowing up the problem to such a degree, we start looking at it in a different way. Well, actually, you know, we've got to attack fast. We know set pieces work for us. It should always be about set pieces. So it just unlocks new thinking. Now, we don't care. You know, we win 1-0. That's enough. That's the point. But we're just framing the problem in such a way that we're forced to think about it a bit differently.
Nice. A couple of things just to pick up. And I think we'll jump on to Lanny. One is we learned so much with England 18s from getting people in Fletch. So I remember vividly every time like Mike Cave came in from Fulham and just said, Rusty, you want these players to be able to do everything and you've already divided them into forwards and backs. And by the way, when they come in, why aren't you doing something to prime them? And we're like, oh my days. And actually another one that was interesting, that so same as you. So we had football come up to Leeds and they said, we want you to find the best defenders here. And they said, well, tell us about rugby defence. No, we're not going to tell you about it, but we just want you to look at it and see what you see. And they started, you know, they would look at scanning and the behaviours and all the stuff that often as rugby coaches we miss because we're so bogged down in our detail. Give me one really good example of where you feel like this disruption has led to something that's had real kind of impact.
Well, I guess, so a really nice one was, So I was working with one of the sales teams at Google, and they're trying to, you know, just reinvigorate how they pitch, how they present, how they engage with clients and customers. And so we framed the challenge. What if you only had 1 minute? What if you only had 1 minute to present? What would you do? And what it did was, again, it just unlocked loads of new thinking about, well, you know, and of course, you know, well, we've got to get to the point. Well, actually, 1 minute is such an extreme. It's not even about getting to the point. What are you going to do? Well, we're going to draw it out. We're going to hit them with a headline. We're going to start using video content to prime the meeting. And of course, you know, with these people, when they are with their clients and their customers, they've got ample time. But it just started to unlock new ideas that they hadn't even considered before. Because to your point, they're so bogged down in the way that it's always been done around here, where you walk into a client, you turn on the computer, and you present from slides. We've got to get them to feel it. We've got to tell them the story. Impactful. It really changed the mindset of the team that I was working with just now.
Nice. And I know you, we're all currently experiencing the biggest disruption ever. That's why there's almost 500 of us on a Zoom call. I mean, you couldn't imagine it, could you? And everyone goes, yeah, but it's, you know, but the reality is, like, the one thing that is constant is change. And I know we'll move on to Stuart now, but the ability of Leinster in recent years to be able to play the game in multiple ways rather than one way means that able to be adaptable has been critical, I guess. So, Lanny, thanks, Kirk. Appreciate it. You don't get a round of applause because everyone's on silent. Stuart Lancaster, aka Fletcher's best boss, been a guy that I've been fortunate enough to spend time with, work with. I know we spoke about it on the last pod. I wrote down three words. I wrote down integrity, hardworking, loyal. The meeting you called in Leeds to share all your learnings and all the IP when you could have walked away and gone and taken that elsewhere was probably one of the measures of you as a human. I'm also really pleased that you've now got your dream job. And as I said on the pod the other day, like, I just love how excited you are about coaching. I know you're equally excited about leadership and leadership development. It's some stuff we touched on. So over to you, mate. Oh, Lanny, you okay? You frozen? Is he frozen? Nick, you might get the call up. You might get subbed in. There he is. Lanny, you back?
I'm back.
Mate, God.
Bye-bye.
So, mate, look, I just said, obviously it's something you're really excited about, developing leadership in players, and clearly see that with your teams on the pitch. So, yeah, mate, go for your life.
Just on the creativity piece first. Because I was thinking about, you know, all the things coaching, I was thinking, geez, I don't think I'm very creative, really. And I think to all the people out there who are probably like me, who aren't that creative, the thing that really resonated with me is you can learn to be creative, I think. It doesn't come naturally to me, to be honest. You know, I'm a doer. I'd be a get my list of jobs, get my coaching session planned, get my review done. I've certainly learned the skill of becoming more creative by freeing my time up in my diary to leave some space to be creative. Does that make sense? I think everyone can be creative, but you need to create the space in your diary and in your mind to do it. And whether it's going for a run, walking the dog, whatever it is, I think everyone can do it. I don't actually think sport do it that well, if I'm being honest. I think you guys, when you were coaching England 18s, and certainly if I'm a coach of an age grade team and I'm sat listening to this, I think you've got a really good chance to be creative as you want. The real challenge at the top of the game, and the pressure is there to get a disciplined, executed performance out of your team. And one of the things that Kurt said, he talked about, sometimes you just have a different mindset. And the only time I can really think about that, it was when I was coaching England. It was 2015 Six Nations, and it was that Super Saturday. We had, I think, Wales played Italy. Scotland played Ireland. Ireland went and smashed Scotland. And we had to play beat France at Twickenham by over 27 points in a game. So then you are half an hour from kickoff. How are we going to go about winning this game? And anyone can remember the game. It was 55-35. Do you know what I mean? And the type of rugby we played and the type of tries we scored was an example of a team free from the shackles of, you know, conformity, if you like, being creative, and it created an unbelievable occasion. Obviously, we didn't manage to nail it in the end, but it was also a big deep breath moment for me as a coach. Yeah, to everyone out there, I think you can become more creative, but you need to give yourself space to think. And I've definitely, you know, at Leinster, found that space better for me over the last couple of years. Probably because I live on my own in a one-bedroom flat in Dublin. And I'm on my own. I don't have a TV, so I'll sit there every night and I'm thinking, how can I make this training session different? The 2% different that Kirk mentioned. How can I make this 2% different than yesterday? How can I make our game plan 2% different than last week? So the opposition don't know what's coming around the corner. And that space I've created by living on my own, maybe, you know, travelling back and forth, sitting on planes, I've definitely become better at that. In answer to your second question on the leadership point, when you and Fletch asked me about coming on this, and you said, right, we're going to talk about creativity, leadership, and teamwork, I'm thinking, creativity, I'm not so good on creativity. Leadership and teamwork, no. You know, this is where I think sport does things well. I do think business can learn from sport, and I'm lucky that I've presented to many businesses and tried to relate the lessons from sport to business, particularly in relation to teamwork and leadership. And every time I've walked out of a meeting with a business team, they've gone, there are so many parallels that are relevant to us. The reason I think sport are strong on leadership and teamwork is because, particularly rugby, is a sport that you cannot win unless you have a cohesive team.
Andy Abraham's right. Lanny needs to move down to the middle of the village where the Wi-Fi is better. He'll be back. Fletch, what was did you have a question for Lanny?
Yeah, I was going to have a question. So we spoke yesterday or the day before, and anybody watches Leinster play, Leinster, the greatest thing about Leinster is the different types of tries that they can score. He was, you know, we were talking about, he got over into double figures. So, you know, lots of teams would have one or two ways of scoring predominantly, whether it be pick and go, a bit of drive, pretty strong out wide. So I am, you know, I am surprised to hear Stu talk about the fact that he would find it difficult. So the question within that would be around, how does he include the players around trying to develop different ways from an attacking point of view, different ways of scoring tries?
And I'm hoping he's going to come back on. Someone also just put up, you're back. So actually, Fletch had a question for you. Well, Fletch, you ask it.
Yeah, Stu, can you hear me?
Yep.
Well, it was just around, we caught up a couple of days ago and you were talking about, look, go and watch this game, have a look at the attack. We actually showed the team of us scoring different types of tries. So you mentioned in double figures, you know,
pretty. 10 tries in 10 figures.
Yeah, so, I mean, where does that come from? If you say, look, it's probably something that I'm not that great at, is it other parts of the coaching team? What's the player's role in all of this?
No, I think it comes from the combined coaching team for sure. But also it comes from learning that if you have one way of playing, you're easy to defend and you're very easy to beat, really. So it comes from the pain of defeat. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But again, anybody watches Leinster play, you've got Leinster rugby, which is moving the ball, lots of different people touching the ball. You keep on top of people. However, you score lots of different tries as well. And so, actually, I think the main question is, what's the player's role in this? How would you include your players around different ways of scoring from a creative point of view?
Lanny's
Wi-Fi. It's gone.
Well, it's the village. You're right, Andy Abraham. The other thing, and I've just put it on the chat room that I was thinking about, and Kirkwood talked about this a lot, is where do you do your best thinking? And I guess my challenge to us as coaches is how often do you create those moments? So Fletcher's is walking the dog. You are currently walking the dog every morning, Fletch, for about an hour. So I'm assuming you're doing some pretty good thinking at the moment. Stuart, by his own, I think Andy put on there, but he's now constrained. He's spending time on planes and on his own, so he'll have a lot of thinking time.
The shower's the number one answer, by the way, in the world.
Is it?
Yeah, it's why we're clean. Let me just say on this, though, there's a watch out here, because I agree. Listen, the science proves it, right? Our mind is allowed to wander and gestate, you know, cooking, people say. Bill Gates claims to do the washing up every night because it's 20 minutes to just let his mind gestate around something whilst it's occupied. The watch out is people can be forgiven for thinking that creativity, it happens when you're on your own. And that's the watch out, because most of those times, walking the dog, driving home, in the gym, in the shower. And so we just have to be careful, because we have to balance that kind of reflection and that thinking time with actually, how do we also do it when we bring those principles to when we're working with our colleagues and stakeholders as well. So actually, could you do a walking meeting? You know, for example, if walking is something that helps repetitive physical motion, could we go and have a walk rather than, again, this river of thinking that we need to get around a boardroom table because it's a meeting, if you like. So yeah, just something on that.
Rusty, just before we go on to Twiggy to see if he's got any observations around creativity, what's the stuff that's killing it? So Dusty Miller, sort of, he asked a question around what's killing creativity, what stuff have you noticed, anything around, I mean, I don't want to put words around the current generation, but yeah, what's the stuff that you notice around stuff that's not helpful for creativity?
Are you asking me and or Kirk?
Yeah, I'm asking Kirk. I'm more than happy for you to answer, mate. And Twiggy, obviously.
Sorry, I zoned out. I thought that was for Rusty.
No, okay. It's for you, mate. What's killing creativity? What's the stuff you notice that's not helpful?
That's not helpful. Hierarchy. So someone asked the question, does it have to come from the top down? Listen, it doesn't. There's always scope. Even if someone says, I want you to do it like this, this is how we do it, this is how we play, this is how we do our job, there's always a little scope for you to go, well, I'm just going to go and do it a bit different. You know, if your job, let's bring it to the corporate world, if it is about going into that meeting, nailing that pitch, well, you know, you might be told that that's what you've got to do. There's no creativity, but how you go and do that pitch, how you run that meeting, there is some creativity. So, but hierarchy, not valuing it, is a good one. Or is one that will always kill it. What else is there?
Shooting it down very quickly.
Yeah, so just not giving it a chance, not valuing it. You know, it sounds silly, you know, expecting someone to come with a fully fleshed out idea that's got all of the business plan. I think there's we have to watch out, right? So what kills it the most? I've got the answer. We have an inbuilt negativity bias as human beings. We're hardwired to seek threat before we seek opportunity. So unless we adopt a deliberate mindset and attitude when we are in those conversations where we're looking at an option or two more to help us get through this situation with more impact, well, we have to recognize that unless we do something, we will be looking at it going, how can this hurt us? We'll be hardwired to spot the threat. So I'd say that it's not a zero-sum game. If you do nothing to dial up your, you know, the nurturing and the environment that you're creating for new thinking to come through, you will by default be creating an environment that is killing it. You know, we've tried that before. 1978, it got tried, didn't work then. Cost too much money. You know, everyone will be able to find those things.
What does it look like in your world, Nick?
Well, first of all, my world is as a practitioner. I spend all my time in a business, working with small teams, generally in a sales kind of context, in technology, in an Asian cultural context, and trying to get those teams to deliver big results. What I spend a lot of time thinking about psychological safety. And I think that, you know, that'd be a good catch-all term to, you know, a lot of the comments we've had about, you know, what kills creativity, what sort of initial conditions we need to establish to let creativity flourish. So I would think a lot about psychological safety and what I would mean by that. You know, I've been in some terrible sort of environments where I've literally heard people talk about the desire to have a fail fast culture, and then 2 weeks later, you know, four people get fired. It's kind of, you know, it doesn't really work. So there's loads of examples like that where lip service is paid to, you know, some kind of organizational aspirations, and yet there's this whole thing about development versus performance, and I'll maybe say a couple of things about that in a second. But you know, we end up having a performance-oriented environment where we pay lip service to organizational aspirations, and I think, you know, whilst creativity doesn't need to come from the top, what we need from the top of organizations is that people are much more intentful about creating, facilitating an organizational environment that can allow a certain amount of safety, so that the organizational antibodies don't kill off creativity.
What type of stuff do you, I mean, so this is Project Aristotle as well from Google, isn't it, Kirk? What type of stuff? And there was a webinar last week on it with Nick Levett around psychological safety. What's the practical stuff that needs to go on for that to be happening?
So I would definitely think about sort of having a much more open and trusting environment. And you know, a lot, and I was part of those environments, I should sort of qualify. So, you know, I was probably part of the problem in many situations. I was fortunate enough to get exposed to sort of youth sports coaching, and was genuinely shaken by how supportive that environment was, how nurturing the environment was. And that really challenged some of my thinking for, you know, my sort of work life. And so then I would go back into a work environment and say, well, you know, what does a more trusting environment look like? What practically can we do? And I think if, as a leader, if you, you know, invite outsiders into your business and people see that you're doing that, then you're making yourself vulnerable. And that starts to signal to the organization, and you know, whether it's an organization or whether it's just, you know, a small sales team, if you're prepared to be vulnerable enough to bring outsiders in, and outsiders don't need to be people, you know, like Kurt or Stuart, it could be, you know, just bringing somebody in from the accounts department and just saying, look, we just want to present how we run our team to you. And, you know, I lead that team and I want your feedback. And if you ask for that in front of your whole team, that sends a really kind of positive signal to those people that, okay, it's okay to be vulnerable. So definitely some stuff around more trusting environment. And, you know, I'd be thinking, you know, inviting parents into huddles, you know, on Saturday morning, is that kind of modeling that behavior. Shift into like a player-centric, you know, having player-centric principles and what that would mean for me. And I think somebody's asked the question, does it come from the top? I think it can turn an organization structure upside down. You can make it non, you know, Kirk talks about having, you know, a non-hierarchical environment. And so I think there's things you can do around that. You can send very clear signals. You can, the way that you conduct account reviews, you know, you could make case clinic type, no rank, no uniform type principles around certain formal aspects of how you review your business. And I think, again, you know, as a team leader or a business leader, it shows a certain vulnerability, and it shows that you're really prepared to get behind some of these principles and say, like, no, you know, there is no rank in the room right now. We're going to spend an hour and we're going to go through a structured process where we're not trying to fix the problem. We're just going to be, you know, very intentful about our listening skills. You know, somebody's going to present a case. We're going to listen to it. We're going to support them in developing their thinking about those particular problems that they're addressing. So that would be something that would be quite keen on. Big sort of thing for me is a shift away from tech tack to a more principles, thinking more about our principles. So for me in business, tech tack would be, you know, build a plan, make it more detailed. When it starts failing, is clearly failing, not because it was a bad plan. We just didn't have enough detail. So we need to reforecast all the sales. We'll get the sales guys to redo their account plans with increasing sort of granularity. That for me is like a tech type focus. And I think we could often benefit from stepping away from that and saying, well, you know, instead of building more detail to justify maybe some flawed assumptions about our business model, our, the way we engage in with a customer, maybe let's take a step back and let's, you know, be a bit more purposeful about our principles. And you know, can we bring some outsiders in? Can we bring the customer in to say, look, you know, these are our principles of engagement with you. You know, did we get this wrong? And then lastly, I think about gamifying like everything we do. And I think I might mention to you before the Owen Slot book about the Talent Lab. Oh, I love something in there about that whole Olympic program. You know, a whole wall in the office was decorated with medal ambitions, and it dominated everybody's thinking every day. What can we do? What small thing can we do today in order to make that medal possibility more of a reality? And the idea that, you know, in a sales context, that we might do that with a wall in the office around, you know, the medals that we're chasing, the big deals that we're chasing. I think that just it becomes more playful, and it stimulates, you know, different thinking about how we might start engaging our customers. So there'd be some sort of really practical stuff that I'd spend time thinking about.
Nice, and I'm going to introduce you in a second, Nick. Very good of Stuart just to leave. A couple of things on there. So Keg Green's talked about the Red Arrows and how they do debriefs. So they do very non-hierarchical. They actually, from what I've heard, they sit in the chairs in the positions of the planes, and they play out stuff, hot debriefs as well. You mentioned principles. So I really remember I went into Loughborough once and someone kind of said, look, this is, and I guess it would have been even better if they hadn't done this, but they said, look, this is what we stand for. We just want you to check and challenge us today. And I wasn't in to do that. Maybe they invite you in and go, what do you think we stand for? Maybe you could kind of report back at the end of the day on what you've noticed. Yeah. And the last thing, and James Bell, and I'll just ask for your thoughts on the psych safety stuff, Kirk, and the Project Aristotle stuff. James Bell, who I know you've just done the podcast with, Fletch, would speak. All of this stuff is about high support. So there's clearly high challenge. There's some whatever our goals and dreams and missions are. But actually, this requires high support. What did you take from that call, Fletch?
Oh, yeah, you pretty much nailed it on the head, really, that there's got to be balance between what the challenge is. Clearly, within business and sport, there's always high challenge. It's it works best when it's matched by the support. So that wouldn't just be creativity, that would just be in general good practice. He referenced it around resilience and psychological safety. So having the appropriate level of support is absolutely key. That's where people are afforded the opportunity to smash it and rock it. Kirk, what's your view on psychological safety?
Yeah, so the work that Google do every couple of years, they renew the survey, but it comes out, two top things that come out for the highest performing teams in our environment. Number one is psychological safety. Number two is a good manager or a good leader of the team. And the two are heavily connected. I spend a lot of people will then go, the obvious question is, well, how do we do it? What is it? I think it's this big area. I try and break it down really, really simply. Do you have an environment where people have a bit of small talk, where they feel comfortable just chatting to each other? I often see, you know, I'll sit in on meetings where I'm coaching or mentoring a leader, and you can see they're sort of edgy to get on with it. Let's get on with it. And their team are naturally priming themselves. They're warming up. They're getting into this relaxed, focused brain state. So and they almost want to push on. So I think it's as simple as, you know, allowing voices. You know, psychological safety for us means that everyone has a voice, and that we design for every different type of brain that we have in our team, in our project, in our meeting. Some people love to talk it out loud, think whilst they're talking. Some people love reflection and a bit of personal contemplation, or working in smaller groups. I think we know this, but we're still a bit clunky in how we design for it. We have to design for both. You know, a little phrase I try and always remind myself is time to think, time to talk. Am I designing for both within my meetings, my project sessions, when we're working together? Half-time breaks, really, really good way to help people to focus. You know, half-time breaks in sport, have a half-time break in your meeting, your conversation, so that those people that get their psychological safety, when they're able to step back and process and then come back again with their thoughts and perspectives, are really is a really powerful and simple way of just getting psychological safety. But get voices in the room, celebrate every opinion. And I think it gets back to this, the ability of the leader of that situation, the facilitator, if you like, to signpost, you know, what's needed from people, the behaviours that are required there, and their ability to role model it as well. So when we talk about leaders, number two, most vital thing to a high performing team, it's leaders that are able to create psychological safety.
Okay, that takes us relatively nicely, and unfortunately, Lanny just sent a message. His Wi-Fi's down, so I don't think.
Andy Abraham needs to get off his... Andy, you're using all the Wi-Fi in Otley. It's all gone. Yeah.
So he's struggling. He's currently trying, however, he may or may not. But he was going to share his sort of leadership experiences, his story and his point of view on it. So Kirk, I think that sort of lends us in. What have you noticed other than sort of behaving in a certain way? What else have you noticed about really strong leadership? What's the sort of stuff that you were talking about?
Sorry, I was just waiting for other people. So strong leader, big picture, little deeds, iconic actions. So I think a few people said there, you know, and Nick was talking about it, a leader, you know, says big stuff, doesn't back it up. So, you know, whenever I'm working with leaders, I'm like, well, what's your iconic action that supports the stuff that you're saying? So actually, if you are saying that you're going to embrace risk and failure, you know, we want to try new stuff. Well, where's your iconic action that supports that? Where's the ability to, you know, where are you celebrating failure? There's a few organizations in Silicon Valley where whenever they're working on innovation projects, if the project fails, the leader of that project is automatically made the leader of the next project, because they, you know, I think that's a brilliant iconic action from the senior leadership, that actually we reckon that person's going to bring so much learning to the next project. That's quite nice for me there. Other things around leaders are I guess those that just recognize that they don't have all the right answers. You know, leadership used to be about being the smartest person in the room. It's now the ability to unlock the smartest thinking. And I think that's quite hard. You know, most of us we've all got to where we've got to at this point in time. The world isn't quite turning on a different axis, but it's close to, with creativity, divergent thinking, you know, get it done task, productivity, binary acts. That's where computers and technology will play a role. So our ability to think and think differently is going to be vital in the future. Most of us have got to where we've got to not because of that. And so it makes sense, the more senior you are in an organization, the more you have been successful by probably being the smartest, most technically advanced person in your area. And I think it's about leaders just kind of having the confidence to kind of ditch that and recognizing, where do I learn? And my job as a leader is to bring all of this different thinking together, not me having the right answer. And that's quite hard, and particularly in different cultures, as Nick said, you go to Asia, where, you know, that's quite hard, because people have grown up through education around with that being very, very, very powerful as well. So I recognize it's hard stuff for people to change and to shift, but most of us, if we're not able to retire in the next 5 years, and by the way, I see leaders literally crapping themselves doing the maths. Can I retire before, you know, this really takes hold and my ability to think and be creative is is a critical skill. And if you can retire in the next 5 years, you're probably going to be okay. But if you can't, then, you know, your ability to help others to think differently is going to be vital.
I'm going to ask, because Vix will be gutted that Lanny's gone, as he's like, Lanny's his hero. I'm going to ask you the question, Fletch. So, and then how would Nick Kirk et al., I'm adding you as the et al., deal with mavericks and creative disruptors that sport often struggles with? So the, you know, the Gazzers, the, who else would be? Who would be the rugby mavericks? Danny Cipriani, maybe, that type of stuff. How would you have dealt with it, fellas? And I'm definitely going to ask you, Fletch, because you would have coached a lot of those type of players.
I think it's a great question. So, you know, anybody who's run...
Can I introduce you, Nick? So just so everyone knows, you live in Malaysia. You're trapped in Sedba. Your son goes there. I wrote down, your wife is the best cook in the world. Hanky is the best cook I've ever had. And you've got great kids, and your wife's a great host as well. But the three roads I wrote down for you were thoughtful, curious, and Kino. And I like Kino. I think it's really important, because whenever we see you at like Sedba or stuff like that, you just want to learn and get better. And I know you've taken lots from, so what I'm interested from your point, you've taken loads from coaching young kids and taken it to coaching older adults in business. So back to the Mavericks.
Back to Mavericks. So I reckon, you know, whether they're under 13s, and you get mavericks who generally think they're way better than all the other kids. And, you know, why is the coach not spending all his time on me? And why do I have to deal with all these other Muppets? Or whether it's a business team where, you know, there's always one person that is generally very intelligent, very creative, and at times will be high performers, but they're also corrosive and disruptive. And I think that, you know, peer coaching, whether it's with kids or whether it's with grown-ups in business, I think you just have to reframe the Mavericks challenge. That, you know, is that your success is not the tries you score or the deals you close. Your success is how you've influenced the behavior of people around you, and, you know, we're going to measure their success as a marker of your success. And so that would be like a, you know, that would be how I would think about it. It's a peer coaching opportunity. And I've definitely had experiences where, you know, I've had team members that were, you know, super high performers, and I've just oscillated between wanting to fire them and realizing I can't live without them. My best outcomes were where, you know, those people, and it's generally, you know, around, you know, what makes those people tick. So I think you have to care. You have to really, you know, understand somebody. You might have to show some vulnerability. You know, when they realize that you're vulnerable and are exposed by some of their behavior, then you can get quite a big behavior change. And if you reframe, you know, what their challenge is, their personal kind of challenge, and get them co-coaching or peer coaching, then I think you can get the best out of those sort of people.
What have you written down, Fletch? And someone's written Jake Sharp on here, which is obviously...
I've just... There you go, great Sharp. He would be a great example. Celebrate it. Just it's part of your culture. That's actually what you're looking for. That's the type of stuff that you want. Probably understand where it comes from. It comes from somewhere. So having a real deep meaning of where this comes from, so understanding stuff that's happened to them in the past, whether it be environment or experiences. Probably match them up with people who are not like them a bit. Often they sort of hang out with each other quite a bit. Don't think that's helpful for them or the team. So maybe sort of part them up with some people who are not like them. I think the tension will create even more magic. And then I definitely agree with Nick, sort of, you know, some peer-to-peer stuff around actually what is appropriate, and, you know, in terms of sometimes when it's probably dialed up a bit, maybe it can lead us to some bad stuff. And just agree what some consequences are around some stuff as well. I think often it's when people don't have those conversations around consequences or potential consequences, when sometimes it's sort of dialed up too much. That's the stuff I'd be thinking about. But definitely go back to the first point, which would be to celebrate it. It's just part of your culture. It's part of what you guys or what we do. You know, we have people who are really pushing it out there.
A couple of people have asked about, and I'm going to ask you, Fletch, and you, Kirk, just because you are naive experts. So, Fletch, you've gone from, you know, fog on the Tyne, working your way up to, you know, working in the pathway to then now working in business. I don't know if anyone knows you work in business. What have you noticed? And the same with you, Kirk, where you've come from business and spending an increasing amount of time in different sport environments as naive experts. What have you noticed? What would you take from business to sport, Fletch, and what would you give to business from sport? Or one or two things?
Yeah, I'll go after Kirk. I think Kirk would be, I think people would, Kirk.
Go on, Kirk, what you got?
Business to sport, yeah, you want from me.
And sport, then, and also sport to business, if you've seen some stuff.
The question that you had earlier in the day, Rusty, you sent it to us on WhatsApp.
Don't suddenly ask. Oh,
it was about sort of constraints, wasn't it? You know, an ability to be creative. I don't know why I was thinking about that. I thought it had some relevance. I think business to sport to business, we performance moments. So sport is brilliant at going, here's when we have to perform brilliantly. The rest of the time is when we develop. So, you know, I use an example, Shanae Miller-Weibo, Olympic 400 meter champion. I think, you know, when she won the Olympics, she competed 9 times that year, you know, so ridiculously low. The rest of her year was about getting good at being those 9 times. So it's quite an extreme case. The business world is the other end of the spectrum. Every day people go in, and unless they're doing something deliberately to change it, they get into this spiral of feeling like every day is a high performance moment. That's not sustainable. At best, you just become average. You know, your average might be high, but if every day you treat it the same and how you show up is the same, then you're just going to be average. So I think that's something that I'm really working hard at, and I'm not having loads of success right now, but I think we'll get there eventually. Of the business world, getting into this mindset of what is my high performing moment this quarter. I worked with a team recently, and we just went through their calendar of the quarter and said, tell me your most important moment of that quarter. And they would point it out and go, it was that. It might be in a meeting. It might have been a project that they were working on. It was their most important moment. And then you looked at their calendar, and they did nothing to protect it. They did, so Stuart would say about that time to think. They did no thinking time. Their calendar was packed, and they might have had this moment, this 2-hour workshop that they were doing on a new product that they were developing. And just before it, they had 3 meetings. And then immediately after it, they had 3 meetings. You know, so there was no time to warm up into it. And then there was no appreciation of the fact that you're going to have this kind of adrenaline, blood sugar drop after, and just to look after yourself. You know, you'd never have a tea, you know, in the elite sport world, you'd never train your ass off in the morning and do loads of other stuff. Oh, and then, by the way, go on and do it after you've competed. So, I think it's just about recognizing when we truly need high performance, we need to protect it, right? We need our rituals that help us to get that. But also as well, recognizing that we have to find moments to try stuff. Because what then they'll tell me, these people that I worked with in their quarter, I'll go, well, show me the least important moments. And they really struggled to go, well, that wasn't such an important meeting. That wasn't such an important interaction I was having. And unless you're able to actually distinguish where you go, right, okay, that's a moment where I can try 2% different. That's a moment where I can try my 10% different. Then again, you'll never develop. So I think, you know, one thing I've taken from sport back into business is this performance moments. When are the truly high performance moments, and how do we behave around those? And being really deliberate of forcing ourselves to recognize moments on the job, which is a term that's used in the corporate world a lot. Where are those moments on the job where we can experiment and try stuff where it's safer to fail?
Nice.
I love that. I think we do a really bad job of making a distinction between performance and development. And in the sporting world, you know, like everybody on this call, when they think about their coaching, that, you know, they would have very clear ideas about what a performance coach does in terms of, you know, how they structure their activities and how they behave, and what a development coach does. We don't have that in business. Business, it's everything's priority one. And as Kirk says, generally, it's like homogenous activity. We don't make big distinctions and set aside time for, right, that's going to be thinking time, it's going to be recharge time. We just don't do that. Everything's priority one, and it's really all about performance. There's little time invested in, you know, genuine development outside of, you know, possible sort of graduate kind of training program type stuff. As soon as, you know, you've kind of got past that phase of your career, it's all about performance. And you know, I was listening to Stuart's podcast the other day, and he talked about, you know, when he started at Leinster, and it made me think about, you know, when we start new jobs, there's actually a window there in the first maybe 6 months where you can be creative because you don't understand how it's always been done. You're not part of that environment. And so there's an affordance for you to be creative. But actually, most organizations don't view that as an opportunity. It's more of like, well, you know, we've just hired this guy, and in 6 months' time, he'll be productive. And kind of what they mean by that is, in 6 months' time, we'll have brainwashed him into doing things how it's always been done around here. We don't actually carve out time to say, well, actually, this person is probably, you know, at their most disruptive, most creative. Let's try and extend this. We'll call this development time while we bring them on board. So we definitely don't. You know, there's a lot of the good things we could do around really behaving differently about development versus, you know, performance in business.
Nick, on that, I'll just jump in really quickly. I think there's an opportunity here for sport or business, because we all have recruit. We all recruit. We all have new joiners. And you know, the reverse onboarding. So to your point, Nick, what happens is you spend loads of time getting really good talent, and then you put them in an induction program and tell them about how things are done around here.
Yeah.
I almost go, we should be spending a month going, tell us how we should be doing things around here. Like, suck their brain of what they know before they get indoctored into the culture of how things are. And I think that probably applies to everyone that's listening as well, that even if you're in a sport environment, you know, if you are bringing in every new joiner has a naivety to your world, and suck their brain on board the company or the team to that person as much as you do the other way around.
Yeah.
Just
like last comment on hiring, thinking about, you know, differences between sport and business. I don't think I've ever been in a business environment where halfway through a year we've kind of said, right, this is going reasonably well, you know, who would our dream hires be for next season? So, you know, we're in this year's sort of this financial year. Next year, who do we want to hire? Let's start targeting them now, in the way that a sports organization would, you know, mid-season be thinking, right, you know, next season, well, you know, we know exactly where we'd want to augment the team, and we'd be very, you know, be very purposeful around the recruitment function, around targeting players, their skill set. But we tend not to do that in business. You know, it's like when a new project initiates, or when somebody leaves, it's like, oh shit, we need to hire somebody. Instead of doing it very purposefully, you know, like, let's think, you know, what does next season look like in business? Just a thought on the recruitment process.
Couple of mentions, and then I'll go to you, Fletch. The book Chasing Stars, very good book around this. Project Oxygen, the stuff you guys did at Google, Kirk, and actually looking at why do we need managers? If we do, what are the skills they require? And the ability to coach being hyper important. And then the last kind of shout out, Tyler Grange, do a bit of stuff, and they would, that do a bit of stuff with, they would, new grads, 2-3 months in would present to the leadership group around, this is how I would make the business better. And they're the naive experts. And it's also a great way to take away hierarchy. Because once again, we're kind of trapped in our rivers of thinking, what are you doing, Fletch? What are you taking to business?
Just some stuff that I've noticed. I've noticed it's very similar. I think sport and business goes really well. It's close enough that it's a related world, but there's enough difference that there's some real good, some real good tension. Probably from sport, the stuff I think sport would do well that business probably should consider. So this would be the sport, high performance sport that's the best. The other two would be around how they design their practice. So they're really intentional around how they design the day, how they design the week. They've got a real good rhythm. They periodize really well. So again, if you take Eddie Jones or Stu Lancaster, our top coach, have a look at how intentional they are around their days and their weeks and their months and how they're in it. They would theme and tell stories really well. So the best sports teams definitely feeding our biases, but teams that are really high performing at this moment in time, often their culture is driven by, it's one of storytelling based around themes. And I do think they have skills around coaching. So clearly within sport, they would be ridiculous around their desire to get better around coaching, especially the how skills. So I've definitely noticed that. And then the last one would be around their...
What how skills are you talking about?
Just a little bit, well, stuff such as show me. I think there's a lot of conversational stuff happens in business. People talk a lot, ask each other questions. I've noticed some very skillful people asking questions, but I've probably noticed less skill around questioning and probably too many questions where there's too much conversation around telling stuff without actually people demonstrating stuff and showing a change of behavior or showing a change of skill. So that would be an example of some house skills. But I do think that if I was just in business, I would be curious around exploring some, if coaching was important, then I would be, I'd be tapping into some sports coaches. And the other way around, so really fortunate to work with a company called Leading Edge, so check them out. But and I'm going to give a guy called Dave Owens a shout out from Jaguar Land Rover, really tough times. I think he's a leader that just models good behavior, does what he says he's going to do, and it just ripples down. It would clearly be obvious, but I do see good leadership within business. Sometimes I think sport pays a little bit of lip service to it. And also they are more intentional around development teams. So the best business I've seen, they would invest in some support around learning and development, either internally or externally. They get people in and look to support them about them developing their team. So what is the framework they want to use around developing their team? It does clearly happen in sport, but often they don't get people in. They kind of do it themselves a bit. I don't think it's as impactful if just to have this, possibly a naive expert, but certainly some support around developing the team.
So you, by that, you mean talking about what's our mission, what's our purpose, what are our behaviours, how do we do stuff around here?
Just to be intentional around actually, are we all going in the same direction? Are we aligned with how we're going to behave? What's the stuff that's important? What's going to make a difference? What's going to be winning or not? And then definitely, sometimes it breaks down where they're just not aligned to sort of how they're going to roll. How are they going to work together? What's important? What does Monday morning look like? What's the purpose of the meeting on a Thursday afternoon? So it's that type of stuff. Business and well does that well. I think sport kind of models through a little bit, really. That's the stuff I've noticed. If I take the best sport and the best business that I've noticed over the last 3 or 4 years, that's the stuff that they can share from each other.
Nice. I'm going to pick up, Nick, actually, your stuff around recruitment. Actually, spoke to a couple of players who moved to a club, and one of the things that attracted them to the club was the fact that the club approached them and said, look, this is what we've noticed about you. Here's your super strengths. We think we can make you an international by A, B and C, and we really want to help you on that journey. And that had pretty big impact on them. I know you've spoken a lot about, I've heard you talk a lot about recruitment, Kirk. You had how many, 16 interviews to get a job at Google, which is... What does recruitment look like at Google? What did it look like? What does it look like now?
The 16 was a bit extreme. That was back in the day where you would get interviewed by anyone and everyone in your team. So it could be that many. But the principle still lives on. Many eyes, many times. That's our principle of leadership, of decision-making, and recruitment is one of those. So how do you ensure that you've just got lots of eyes looking at the thing so that bias, it's mainly so that bias doesn't come in and so that people don't hire people like them. One thing Google, you know, what Google really does well around recruitment is, you know, it's consistent. Everybody has 4 interviews, and they are interviewed on technical ability, leadership. Everyone is interviewed on leadership, even if you're a grad, your ability to lead, because you lead projects, you lead a meeting, you lead a conversation, you lead yourself. So leadership's one. General cognitive ability. So are you smart? We talk about smart creatives. That's how we refer to Google. We want people that know stuff, that know lots of stuff about lots of different things. But we also want the creative bit, the ability to collide all of that stuff you know in different ways. And then the fourth one is googliness, which is culture. So everyone will be interviewed on that. What I like about that, and it comes back to this point that some people are making in the chat, only 25% of what you're being interviewed on is your technical ability. Now, we try and ensure, you know, often it's the first amongst equals and so on, but you wouldn't be interviewed if you weren't technically good. You don't get to that point. So by the time you get interviewed, I think that's a really nice way of ensuring that you are hiring for the right type of person, type of culture. And our experience, we have a really low churn of staff, involuntary churn, so people that are not right for the business who we asked to leave. It's really low, so that says that we're doing something right. I think there's a where I see it, where it blows my mind a bit. So we spend a lot of time and money on recruitment, but once we've then got those people, we then trust them, and we let them get on with it. There's an expression at Google which is flying freely within a gilded cage, and it's just about recognizing, you know, be really clear about what we're trying to achieve, what the goal is, what your constraints are, and then you trust you've got good people and you let them fly within that and do great stuff. You know, the other school of thought is don't spend lots of time on recruitment, make it fast, bring people in quickly, and then micromanage them. It's worse, the worst that you can do is do both. I see people now trying to spend a lot of time and money on recruitment to get it right and then still micromanage them when they're in the business as well. Doing both makes no sense to me. Just pick one. And in Google's case, we put our effort into that recruitment in the first place.
Kirk, just to stir on you and Nick, it's the same question for you as well, mate. What about high performing environments? What sort of stuff do you guys do at Google around trying to create an environment that
is going to What does it mean? What do you think it means? So I think we've mentioned high-performing environments a bit. What do you think that means?
I'm recognise I'm hogging the airspace, and Nick, please do jump in if you've got examples from other worlds as well, because Google doesn't always do it brilliantly. One thing to warm us up, though, I would say is there is the environment. You have the ability to change your environment. So it's not one size fits all. So listen, it's not beanbags and laissez-faire. The slides have gone, you know, it's not what it's about. What it is about trying to, our real estate and workspace team, I think, is our most undervalued department in Google. They are brilliant. They do brilliant stuff. And it's all about, back to that question, where do you do your best thinking? Now, we try and take the principles of those things and bring them into our environment. So in our office in Singapore, it's a huge building and it's on one or two floors, mainly on one or two floors. There is walking lines. So we buy into the principle that a great environment is one where people can move. They can use our physical state, improves our mental state, helps us think about the stuff we're working on. It's quite hard in Singapore, the humidity, and on the 30th floor, to just go outside for a walk. So you can join a line. There is a line on the floor, and it tells you that if you walk that yellow line, it's a 15-minute walk back to this point again. And it's a, and I think that's a brilliant example of just actually what we're trying to do is take those environments of where people do their best thinking, and best we can bring it into this corporate space. But we also, because the watch out of this whole situation we're in right now is that companies are going to go, right, we're all going to work from home. Okay, that's dangerous. Okay, productivity, people feel like they might be getting loads done. My emails are really, really low, but we've not got those casual collisions. So we want people to want to come into work, to want to come into space. Someone sent me an email the other day and said, can you help us with some stuff? It's not, our problem isn't money in this situation. Our problem is morale. You know, we got a small team. This was a small team of people who love coming to work and in that environment. They're saying, and actually, they're struggling by not having that stimulus with each other. So I think it's about environments are those that take those principles of when we're at our best, working from home or outside, kicking stuff around over a beer or a coffee, and bring it into to the workspace.
And I would completely echo that. But what I would add to it is, so I've been really fortunate in that a large part of my career was spent with startups, small, medium-sized tech companies. And then towards the sort of latter part of my career, I've spent time in like big corporate environments, and a lot of what Kirk talks about, you have to work really hard to create that in a big corporate environment, and organizations like Google clearly do and are very successful in doing it. I can't say that in my experience that the corporate environment has done it particularly well. So, I've not seen a lot of what I would term high performance in a corporate environment. In a smaller environment, I think it's much easier to create those conditions for high performance. And I've been really lucky in that to be involved in some like super high performing teams. And common to those was an absolute clarity of purpose. Generally, because the stakes were impossibly high. So when the stakes are high, people get very clear about what their purpose is. And especially if you're trying to disrupt an industry and there are some sort of juggernauts in the industry, think you're going to fail, then again, you've got clarity of purpose. You've kind of got a motivation to succeed. And I can think of one case in particular that really stands out. It was probably my sort of best experience. It was about creating stories, and the guy who was running that organization, who I'm still very much in touch with, said in one of the very first sort of team meetings that he wanted to create the best work experience that we had ever had, make stories that we'll be telling each other in 10, 20 years time. And that created a performance culture where, people were prepared to run through walls. And if I think back to the best environments I've been in, I'm sort of still in regular contact with all those people. So I think a lot of it comes down to some of the things you'd find in great sports environments, great trust, real care, between team members. I think that's a precursor to high performance. So yeah, they're more kind of personal experiences that I've had than truths. But yeah, that'd be my experience.
Rusty, what's your view, mate? You've been reasonably quiet. What's your what's the best environments you've seen? What stuff did you notice?
I've written a few down. I've been thinking about it because I was going to ask you the same question. I'll let you think about it. Number one, Bridge School. They have a shared purpose, and I don't like the phrase, but it's they want people to be industry ready. So people go and they leave and they get jobs in the arts and all of that. What did I love about it? I've never seen a leader who cares so much about people. First headmaster to ever hug me. Since I've told subsequent headmasters, I get much more hugs. But hug me the second time he met me. And just how they inspire. He knows everyone's name and they get really excited about, let's call them mavericks just for the hell of it. But they get really excited about people like that. So I'm sure I've told you the story where I actually saw a kid on a bike and I thought in any other school you'd be bullied. You're a rock star here. How fucking cool is that? Excuse my French. So number one. Second one, actually love, although it wanes on me, so it's law of diminishing marginal utility, going into Google. I think it's an inspirational space. I think the casual collisions Kirk talks about. I mean, actually met one of my old friends, Nick Drake, the other day, which is cool for you because he is a rock star.
Doing significantly better than I am. Let's put it that way.
and we just how it creates collisions. I think it would be a place where they've thought a lot about the architecture. And then, although they're over the salary cap, I compare what Saracens did, you know, so where they train at St. Albans, having one big room, so people are just interacting with each other all the time. I think Birmingham City Academy, we'll give them a shout out. I think they want to get better every day. I think there's a diverse coaching group, and they challenge each other. They jump in and out of each other's sessions. I can see on the kids' faces that it's a great place to be. And then clearly some of those lads go on and do all right. So Jude Bellingham. I'll give a shout. I know you've given a shout out. I'm giving a shout out to Tyler Grange, but at the, and Simon's on it, because I saw he asked a question. At the Christmas do, two people told me this business has saved my life. Wow. And that's so, I'm going to ask you the question, Fletch, because the other one I do think, like, working in the pathway was like, I learned so much. And what I saw there was, and it's a shame Lanny's not on, but I know he's your best boss, but just people who care, people who want to get better every day. It's the behaviours. I think that's what high performing is. It's just about how people behave with one another. People that were willing to challenge, but then kind of get on with it. Lots of actual real expertise. Lots of people have much more expertise than me, and we use brilliantly as a team. So, you know, James Bell, Grant Beasley, you know, just Penny, all the people who just had functions that, and then probably the last thing, everyone got to do their strengths. So we weren't like spending 90%, and, you know, I don't know if Jeff's on here, but Jeff Williams, you know, Rusty, I spend 90% of my time at Bath practicing the stuff I'm not very good at. How do you think I feel about myself? I just, you know, you're a great boss. And actually, I love that with hockey, Stu Guys just said, look, I want you, just choose what you want to do. Just what excites you the most? I'm like, you're the best boss in the world. So that type of stuff really, really resonates with me. Maybe I should have said plan and process and stuff, but I don't think it's that. And the other thing that really kind of works for me is, as, and you've mentioned it, Nick, is just telling a story, being connected to a narrative. I love that. I love the theming stuff at the moment. So shout out to Dave Sharkey and the stuff they've done. What are you thinking, Fletcher? I've spoken way too long.
Really quickly, Google, in terms of the architecture, sort of, it definitely forwarded it to people bumping into each other. Ajax, in terms of the development stuff, so if you want to go and have a look around people, developing people, so from a football point of view, the most successful team, if success means players from their region playing at a certain level of football, Ajax are still, they're still the guys that smash it. Recently went to Mars. I love how they're connected to their purpose.
Not the planet,
but the company. Anyway, where you take your dog into work. So Mars Pet Care, they're doing some work with them, and it was just awesome. So every day there's pets. So actually, they're having conversation about pets, and pets are running around. I think it's really helpful when a cat and a dog are kind of wandering around the building. I thought that was awesome. I loved Falcons Academy. I love them still. But a year ago, my son had an experience which was just a phenomenal experience. And the people around that was fantastic. And Saracens would be the most welcoming environment I've ever been in. So when you go into Saracens, everybody talks to you. Everybody's genuinely pleased to see you. Everybody's curious. So, and that's still the case. So they would be my shout outs in terms of environment stuff for people that maybe.
And as a leader, so as you were a leader in a pathway until a bigger leader came in and took over, what would you have been trying to do? What would you be going, these are my principles as a leader?
Yeah, just trying to get the best out of people, create an environment where people can try stuff, where people can play to their strengths. I think it's important. Just, we were really deliberate around not having anything that was that formal, because then creates the casual collisions, it creates informality. Our best meetings were at night with a Diet Coke and a packet of crisps and just having some conversations. Or
you always said, and you never did it, we definitely should do a week without meetings.
Yeah. Well, I do think meetings often. So we spoke a little bit around creativity. Often they're not helpful for creativity. I think I'd be having less time. People are then more likely to deliberately go and bump into somebody. If you starve people of information, they're more likely to go and find it. So that would be the stuff that would be important. And just I'd be thinking, how do I want people to feel? How do I want people on the drive here? I just get most excited when people used to send me a message, look, I'm so excited to come. That was awesome type stuff. Plus also challenge. I think people would think we were pink and fluffy and cuddly and we're not. We weren't. We would definitely have some conversations where people would feel a bit uncomfortable and with each other. That would be it. I'm just conscious of time, Russ. Yeah, it's this.
I'm going next to my bed. Be more pirate. I know John O'Connor's reading it and he's trying to encourage more people, but this would be, so one of your big things, one of your big principles, Kirk, is around break the rules, but I love this. It says break the rules and make some new ones. So let's make some new rules around meetings and around recruitment and let's just try some experiments.
Just on that, Rusty, very quickly, if you're sitting there thinking, we can't do that, to your point, break the rules, try some new stuff, get disruptive. If someone had said a year ago that the NHS would build the world's largest hospital in 2 weeks and have it up and running and operational, you'd think they were crazy. But if a traditional organisation like that can do it, well, then we all have that ability to be creative in us and to disrupt ourselves to make things happen.
That's cool. Rusty, do you want to go top two? Not necessarily things that you would. What's the stuff that you've learned from somebody else on this panel? I mean, I've been making, as I do all the time, just
written some notes. I've written some notes from in the chat as well about the Rise Zone and various books and stuff that I need, liberating structures. And so I really appreciate that. What have I learned from the people on here? I've learned from Kirk that I love the let's create more possible options. I think in rugby we're really, and I'm going back to sport, we're really limited around, there's a couple of forms of defence. In hockey we go, well, it's zonal or it's this or it's not that many options. I think if we were to think a bit more divergently, then we would be ahead of everyone else instead of copying them. From Nick Twigg I've learned you can still be 10 years older than Rusty and be really keen. And it's not, as you said, Nick, you are 10 years older than me, but you're changing every day. So what I get stressed out about is when, and I love your energy, but people just don't change. I mean, my days. So I'm lucky that I work with people that change. From you, Fletch, that caring is being, how people feel is the most important thing. And from Lanny, I know he's not on, he's just trying to dial up now on his dial-up. For a guy to go from as low as he went to, so from a leadership point of view, and really stay strong to what he believed in and go and do what he's done now is like mind-blowing, really. Mm-hmm. Just think it's class. I do think he's got, and in the words I wrote, he's got high integrity, he's hardworking, he's loyal. I think he's the leadership stuff he demonstrates is class.
Nick, what about you, mate? A couple of things to share. What's your stuff or stuff that you've heard that's resonated?
Yeah. So the thing that I've written down and put a big box around it: behavior eats process for breakfast. Thank you, Kirk. I'm like really big on behaviour, whether it's under 13s or whether it's colleagues or even myself. I've like invested a bit of time on trying to understand behaviour change and what stops us changing our behaviour. I love the notion that kind of pulls all that behaviour stuff into a nice kind of behaviour eats process for breakfast. Love it.
Kirk, mate, last one. We'll finish.
I really love the examples that you and Rusty shared high performance environments. So my brain, my river of thinking always goes to physical space, and you've given me really nice, you've opened my mind to, when we think about environment, it's this as well. So I really love those examples you gave.
The one thing for me is creativity. I do think possibly actually presenting that to some people who would struggle a little bit with creativity, because often they go, that type of, so creativity often gets a bad shout out, which I think is really tough. But maybe you can present that first. It's not going to be creativity, it's going to be creativity. So thanks for that.
There's a book I'm recommending to lots of people at the moment that I think is a great way of facilitating some of this stuff. And it's a book called Game Storming. And it talks a lot about the divergent and the convergent and how you can do it and how you can tell a story. And I think it's a really useful book for anyone who's involved in business. The last thing, and this is probably my take home, because someone just wrote, who wrote the book, I just saw. And there's a book called Teach Like No One Is Watching. Like, if we could all just coach or lead or be ourselves. So that would be the thing we often... That was the hardest part for me but the last 2 years, just when someone doesn't allow you to be yourself. So I think I'm talking about the strengths and stuff again, but being able to teach like no one's watching. So everyone take your socks off. Let's just chill out and have a really cool lesson type stuff. Anyway, that's just me.
Cool. Rusty G, do you want to call it a wrap?
Let's call it a wrap. Kirk, Nick, thanks so much. Lanny, less so. disappointed. We've got a podcast with him, though, and we're going to do a pod with Kirk, so that'll do that. And, good. Be safe, everyone. Be safe, people.
See you, folks.
Thanks, guys. Awesome. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your time.